This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, a conversation with Griffith Police Chief Greg Mance about the upcoming police candidate training workshops that will happen at IU Northwest. Police departments across the region are looking for qualified people, females as well as minorities, to be police officers, and that's what the workshops will help find. Also, too, we have a conversation as well, again, with Jeff Brown, who is the man who's in charge of the Valparaiso University Jazz Festival that gets underway next week. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Diversity on police department is just as important as anything else in trying to be able to have a good rapport with the public, and police officers are learning that more and more every day as we have more incidences like the ones that we've experienced in Ferguson, as well as in New York City and Baltimore and other bigger cities. These problems don't want to happen in Northwest Indiana, and there are ways that you can keep from that happening by the proper training, and in turn that comes with, of course, starting at, I guess, what you could consider as police academy or something like it. And we have with us to talk about, at least as far as the community of Griffith is concerned, Police Chief Greg Mance with us. Chief Mance, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
It's very important that the police officers, of course, get the proper training. Many of them come in with some experience, I know, if they've been in the military, with military police and related training. Maybe they've had training with some other police department, but everybody kind of starts from scratch, don't they? And especially these days when it's so important to be trained properly. Tell us what experiences that you've encountered as being the police chief with Griffith, and how you hope that maybe with the next round of police candidate training that might get improved or get changed.
Yes, be a pleasure. I came to Griffith PD in 1999 as a patrol officer tested. I was fortunate enough to get hired by the very first department I applied with. That's kind of a unique experience. Eventually, I worked my way through the department in various ranks and positions, and in 2013, I became the police chief. And almost immediately upon becoming chief, I was tasked with the responsibility of doing a hiring process.
Mm-hmm.
And in that process, I found I used the same system that other chiefs prior to me had used, and I had the same response that they had. I had relatively small interest in the application process. I think I had 63 people apply, and of those that applied, very few were females or minorities. And during the testing process, I found that many were not qualified, not prepared to take the very unique test that we do that's mandated by state for entry into law enforcement. And when you have very small numbers of females or minorities in that process, just by statistics, they're going to get dropped from the process because there's so few of them.
Yeah.
So the next cycle that I had, it was 2015, so I wanted to try a different approach. So I enlisted some help from some friends that I had, Dr. Ellen Gerletta, the director of Indiana University Northwest's Center for Urban Regional Excellence, was a former professor of mine. I reached out to her and mm-hmm. Dr. Ferrandino, another professor at IUN, as well as some representatives from Crossroads YMCA, mainly Carl Zabriggan, the executive director, and Sharon Bowling, the wellness director. And I met with them trying to come up with a police candidate training program where we could, of those people who are interested, whether they be white, black, Hispanic, female, anyone could come take this practice session where they would learn, have a better idea of what to expect when they came for the physical portion of the test, the oral interviews, and the written test.
Okay.
And the idea was just to get everyone to show that Griffith PD was really ambitious about helping these candidates succeed, and that we were very aggressive in our efforts to recruit minorities and females and to make the playing field very level. So even if you'd never applied for a department before, you might have the same skill or knowledge of that testing process as someone who's gone through two or three prior.
Yeah. If you will, take a few moments and explain to us, you kind of alluded to it at the beginning of our conversation about the fact that maybe this exam to be able to become a police officer statewide. It's not just the town of Griffith, but statewide is so difficult, in particular for minorities and for females. What is it about the test that you're hoping that with this help you'll be able to overcome the barriers of getting more women and more minorities in as police officers?
I mean, the biggest issue that we have regionally, and I think nationwide, is there's not a lot of interest or perceived interest by females and minorities to get into the profession of law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we've have to work on. It's not going to be fixed overnight. And then when you have a testing process that is somewhat unique, you have these females and minorities that apply for these jobs, and they get discouraged, and they might not apply again. And the test, the written test, is unique. It's not just a multiple choice test. If you haven't taken a test in a while, it's a little bit challenging. If you've never taken a law enforcement type of test, it's even more challenging. So What this workshop does is it kind of prepares people for just general test-taking tips, as well as give them an idea of some of the questions they might be asked. Yeah, for instance, there's questions about, there'll be a map illustration. It'll ask the applicant to navigate the quickest route to a certain area on that map. So again, it's not a test you would have taken in high school, but it's a test that you're likely going to be tested on for the police exam.
I would imagine, too, that probably there are, of course, questions on the exam as well, too, that deal with the psychological issues, analysis, maybe a situation an officer has to come up upon, and dealing with people at the scene of an incident of some kind, whether it's a crime or whether it's just an accident or something even simple as that.
Yes, it's a very all-encompassing test.
Yeah.
Tries to measure of what the applicant, how they might perform if they were in fact hired.
Mm-hmm. And I know too that as you mentioned before about the fact that the physical exam is very strenuous. In working with the folks at IU Northwest as well as the Crossroads YMCA, and in coming up with this way to help female and minority police candidates get through this, what kinds of ways on the physical end of the exam do you to help them out?
So what the YMCA did was they looked at the actual physical exam that these departments are mandated to give by the state.
Mm-hmm.
And when the applicants come in with this police candidate training program, we actually show them the test. This is what you're going to be required to do. So you're going to be required to do so many sit-ups within a minute, so many push-ups within a minute. You have to run a certain distance in this time frame. You have to jump within a certain height just with a vertical jump. So what the YMCA does is they have some trainers there, and we also bring in some officers from region-wide departments that do this type of training, and they actually act as coaches for the applicants. So the applicants get an opportunity to run through the tests they're going to be required to take when they apply for a department, and then if they fall short of what they need to pass to go on to the next process, the YMCA and the officers give them coaching tips on how they can better prepare themselves. We often find that some females lack the upper body strength to do the required number of push-ups. So they're able to give adequate coaching so they can prepare themselves. So when they do take that test in a month or two or 6 months down the road, they're at a much better advantage to pass that test.
Does that seem to help, I guess, if an applicant comes in and maybe they don't pass the test the first time around because of physical limitations of some type, that this is the right kind of training, right kind of conditioning that'll help them try again, and the second time around they'll make it in?
Yes. Fortunately, we launched this program in 2015. Based upon that, we hired our second female in the department's 115-year history.
Mm-hmm.
She was a former Olympian, someone that was in great physical shape. But because of the sport that she was in, she still had some areas where she could improve upon. And just in speaking with her, it was the guidance that she received through our police candidate training program that helped her succeed in passing that physical portion of her test, and she was ultimately hired. So, we've had some early success in this workshop. We hired a female that might not have made it through our process. She's very qualified and very skilled. We're happy to have her, And I think this process might have, helped her along with that process.
I was going to say, too, that probably for her standpoint, too, that probably makes her feel more confident, and she makes not only a better police officer, but more comfortable in staying with the force and some longevity there, too, rather than deciding that I'm going to try this for a while and have to drop out.
Yeah, no, one of the things that, I think not only my department, but any department that does a process like this, it's showing your candidates and your applicants that you're there to make them succeed. You're there to offer them every tool possible for them to succeed. And with that, you will have some buy-in to the department and some longevity.
That's great. Well, all that that longevity, I guess, goes back to the proper training, and that's what this is all about, being able to be a good candidate for service as a police officer in the town of Griffith or any place, I suppose, in Northwest Indiana. And that's where the police candidate training comes in here. Give us some of the particulars about the next sessions coming up.
Yeah, again, so it's the Griffith Police Department, the Center for Urban and Regional Excellence, and the Crossroads YMCA have all joined up to sponsor this event. It'll be Saturday, May 19th at Indiana University Northwest from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. Anyone who's interested in applying for a position with any local law enforcement agency is encouraged to apply. It doesn't have to be just Griffith. If you've got an interest in working for the Sheriff's Department or even the railroad police, you're likely going to have to take a very similar type of test. And this workshop will provide you with the useful tips and techniques to help the applicants advance in the hiring process.
Well, Chief Mance, it sounds like that this will be a great opportunity for people who are truly interested in becoming a member of law enforcement in Northwest Indiana, as well as just the community of Griffith alone, but to learn more and to be able to be properly, I guess, acclimated and in turn be conditioned to know what it's going to be like when you go to the training as a police officer, to be sure. And it sounds like a lot of people, I think, have had the interest and they're going to sign up, and we'll probably have a full class or so come the session coming up in May.
I think we will. I'm very hopeful of that. If the application process will open April 1st and run through May 16th, anyone who's interested can register at griffithymca.org.
Griffith Police Chief Greg Mance, thanks very much for being with us to talk about this today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Police Chief Greg Mance with the community of Griffith. The next round of police candidate training is going to be underway with the registration coming up here in April. But the training process is going to begin involving the IU Northwest Center for Regional Excellence, as well as the Crossroads YMCA. The workshops will be underway with the next training of police candidates.
A very unique South Lake County bed and breakfast is featured as Indiana's only listing on a special U.S. list on a national website. Booking.com regional manager Shane Moody was on Regionally Speaking to talk about what a monolithic dome outside Lowell can bring visitors.
We're currently inspiring travelers to find and book the most incredible accommodations across the U.S. with our newly launched Book the U.S. list. That was curated by experts at Booking.com and features the coolest, most unique properties across all the U.S., ranging from options like landmarks to caves in New Mexico, castles in Kentucky, tree houses in Ohio, and more. It's only fitting if property is spectacular as time for bed in Indiana made the list.
We'll talk in more detail here about this place here, which is located not far from Lowell in South Lake County. But in Illinois, even the house that's unique there, the bed and breakfast, is set up in a what used to be a Frank Lloyd Wright home.
Correct. Outside of Chicago, we have a Frank Lloyd Wright home, and it's a beautiful property itself. And, it's a great example of the many unique properties that we have featured on this list for travelers to go experience.
Now, since you have probably so many opportunities to choose from to be able to put locations on this list, how did you come up with the one that we have here in Northwest Indiana?
We really worked with our local teams and some experts in booking to come up with the most unique destinations and unique experiences for our travelers. I would say Time for Bed is one of those, a monolithic dome that built in 99 that was fireproof, concrete, steel shell that could sustain winds to 300 miles per hour. And that's all in beautiful rolling countryside of Lowell, Indiana. Where guests can enjoy bird watching, fishing, hiking trails, horseback riding, and just a quick 10-minute drive from historic downtown Lowell. So we think this one fits the bill as far as being unique and a great place to experience.
As we mentioned here, this location is in South Lake County. It's, as you mentioned, it's called Thyme. That is spelled the same as the herb, T-H-Y-M-E, Thyme for Bed Dome. It is a monolithic dome that's out there. In fact, it's located on West 185th Avenue in Lowell. So it's easy to get to from the area highways and to go out there. But still far enough away, I'm sure, for a very, very nice stay or a week, I guess a weekend, if you want to make a weekend out of it as well, too. Describe this place, if you will, please.
It's owned by Crystal and William Britzman, and they built this place in 1999, and it's something to definitely foresee, so I encourage your listeners to go on to booking and check it out. It's an amazing place, and the service there is even more incredible based on the guest reviews that we have. And it has, you know, several bedrooms, a see-through fireplace, a jacuzzi inside of it. And it's always good, safe and secure to know that it could survive 300 mile an hour winds. So I guess it's a place to run to if you have a local storm going through as well. But based on reviews, it is an incredible place to experience and check out with the great host from Crystal and William Britzman. Let's mention it's like a quick 10-minute drive from historic downtown Lowell, which features a lot of quaint cafes, boutiques, and small markets. For travelers to go and experience the countryside and some of the downtown shopping and you know, eatery locations as well. So then you're only a short hours or drive from Chicago as well. So a good chance to go to the city to experience other, like you mentioned, Frank Lloyd Wright's Emil Bockhaus. Or if you want to travel to neighboring states, you could go and experience the tree house in Ohio. We have a mushroom house in Michigan that looks like a home that's straight from the Shire from Lord of the Rings, and it's a really cool style. But we also have a castle in Kentucky if you want to drive down to Kentucky to experience that as well. So some really great, unique properties to experience.
Now, if you check out the listing that's on booking.com and look into this particular location there in Lowell, you'll get some reviews from people. What kind of reviews have you received from travelers and people who have stayed at the Dome since it's been on the list?
We have some great reviews, very highly reviewed. Pretty much say it's an amazing gem, and they really enjoy the unique experience of staying there. But more than that, it's the hospitality that they get from Crystal and William from staying there, from good food, good service, and just warm hospitality. And like you mentioned before, it's a unique place. They even say they have a gaggle of pheasants where you could actually go outside, sit out there, watch pheasants and other birds, and then get a chance to hike the trails and do a little bit of horseback riding while you're experiencing out there. So a little bit of peace. But yeah, the reviews speak to that, and very highly reviewed and recommended place to stay.
I took a look at one of the reviews that was listed with the heading as Hope to Return. So somebody must have stayed apparently for the night or maybe a day or two, and they're making a trip, I guess, on a business run, so to speak, and then they stopped by, made arrangements, and enjoyed staying overnight. And they got quite impressed, I guess, not only by the surroundings that they were in, but about the comfort of the B&B to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely. You wouldn't think first thought of staying in a dome as being very comfortable. But that's exactly what the reviewers say, is they really enjoy the uniqueness of the experience, the countryside, as well as having some great hosts who own the property as well.
That is Booking.com's Shane Moody talking about a bed and breakfast that's located outside Lowell. It's on the website, but it's the only Indiana posting in a special national list. President Trump's tariffs on imported steel and aluminum went into effect on Friday, and they could negatively impact a growing industry in Indiana. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier reports that craft brewers are preparing for some increased production costs as a result.
When you walk into the tap room at Sun King Brewing in Indianapolis, one of the first things you notice is the noise. There's the constant hum of brewing equipment in the background, and some of it comes from the nearby canning line. An automatic belt twists and turns cans through the room as they're sanitized, filled, sealed, and packaged.
Last year, we produced the equivalent of 30,000 barrels worth of beer, which is 60,000 kegs of beer, and a little over 50% of it went into aluminum cans.
Clay Robinson is a co-founder and owner of Sun King, which is one of the largest breweries in Indiana. He decided to can beer long before it became popular across the industry.
We were actually the 53rd canning craft brewery in America. And since that time, it's grown to upwards of 600 or 700 canning breweries.
canning beer is more economical for most breweries. The cans protect the beer from sunlight and oxygen and are lighter to transport. But costs for breweries who package their beer in cans will likely go up with the introduction of a 10% tariff on most imported aluminum. The Brewers Association says 98% of can aluminum is produced and made into cans in the U.S., but they worry the tariffs could incentivize an overall rise in aluminum prices. Robinson says he isn't sure how much of a hit Sun King will take.
We have a contract on our aluminum for the entire year of 2018, so we won't see any major impact on it until the beginning of next year, but that'll be something that once it goes into place and we find out what it's really going to do to the cost of aluminum, that we'll have to figure out what that does to the overall cost of beer.
Smaller Indiana breweries like Taxman Brewing in Bargersville are more likely to feel the immediate impact of the tariffs. About half of the beer Taxman produces every year is canned. The brewery's suppliers encourage them to stockpile as many cans as possible at the current price to temporarily avoid increased costs. But Chief Production Officer Colin McCloy says they don't have the storage space to do that.
Cans are always funny because you have to, when getting printed cans, order a truckload, which is 25 pallets of 8,169 cans each.
McCloy says it's too early to tell just how much more they'll have to pay for cans. But he says it's an increased cost they'll have to figure out how to make up.
There is a possibility that our prices would have to reflect it. That's going to be a last resort. Obviously, we want to make it as accessible as possible.
Keith Belton is director of the Manufacturing Initiative at Indiana University. He says it's likely a lot of industries, not just breweries, will have to pass on the increased costs to consumers, and it could happen soon.
I would say that you will see price increases from producers to their customers starting pretty immediately after March 23rd, if not already in anticipation of March 23rd.
But here's the silver lining. Belton says the price increase could be so minimal on something like a can of beer that you might not even notice.
The price of a car, for example, because it has steel and aluminum in it, could be expected to rise by as much as 1% as a result of these tariffs. And the price of, say, a can of soup could be expected to rise less than a penny.
With even some of Indiana's smaller brewers on track to can more than 1 million beers this year, even a slight increase will add up to a significant cost. And Robinson says at Sun King, it's more than just cans they're worried about.
Aluminum cans are in people's hands every day, so it's a really easy thing to talk about. But the back end of our industry is run by stainless steel. So any increase in the price of materials definitely affects people's ability to grow their businesses.
With the tariffs in effect indefinitely, those are costs that will add up significantly over time. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
The Indiana Department of Natural Resources is proposing several changes to fish and wildlife policies, including one that would allow the hunting and the trapping of bobcats. These proposed changes are causing some outrage in some cases, and as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lindsay Wright reports from southern Indiana, some are calling for more information.
Picture a quaint 7-acre property with enormous snow-covered trees, a good-sized pond in the middle. That's where James Mahoney lives in southern Indiana.
So we come over here.
As he trudges through the snow, he points out a trail camera on one of the trees. He loves to watch wild animals walk around his home.
Anything that walks in front of this camera out to so many feet, 50 feet or so, it'll take its picture and you'll see it walk by.
Mahoney has a special compassion for animals. He owns several horses, some chickens. He even rehabilitates some creatures, including a fox named Baby.
Come here, Baby. Be good. Be a good girl.
That's why it's kind of surprising for people to learn the 79-year-old has been hunting and trapping animals his whole life.
We could love these animals to death, but if there's not a harvest, then you got an overabundance.
And he thinks it could be time for the state to start allowing bobcat harvesting. He's taught hunter education for more than 40 years and says it's just part of the conservation. The DNR points to evidence they say shows the bobcat population in Indiana is robust enough to start a hunting season. Numbers started going up in the early 2000s, and now bobcats seem to be thriving, especially in the southern part of the state. Fur bearer biologist Jerrianne Albers says workers don't do population counts because it's costly and the numbers are always changing. Still, the species has been spotted in more than half of the state's counties since 1970.
What we do instead is we look at trends. So the surveys we have, and for bobcats, we have two main ones and then a third one we use to supplement it. We look at how the population is changing and at what rate it's changing.
Bobcats, at least in the southern Indiana part.
At a recent public meeting in Mitchell, several farmers and hunters spoke in favor of the proposal. Trapper Charles Davis says the species is wreaking havoc on their properties and depleting the turkey and rabbit populations.
This year, I quit trapping coyotes because I couldn't run the traps for the bobcats. I caught two bobcats and I only had 10 traps out.
But that's not good enough for Sierra Club director Bowden Quinn. He worries allowing hunting could, once again, put the population at risk. He says there needs to be specific data. And aside from that, he says there could be an economic incentive to let bobcats be for now.
I've seen bobcats twice, not here in Indiana, but in California. And it's a big thrill. And, of course, you only see it for a second because it's taken off. But how cool would it be if in Indiana people had a chance to see bobcats when they went for a walk in the woods?
Bobcat hunting isn't the only proposal causing outrage. Another policy would require animal control workers to euthanize raccoons, opossums, and coyotes. Although the DNR says the process would only be used in rare situations when removal is necessary, some workers say they should have a choice. As Mahoney throws a pile of hay into an enclosure for his horses, he says people should listen to the DNR when it comes to these issues. He says conservation experts exist for a reason, and the state should consider their expertise.
Because they're knowledgeable. Because that's their profession. Not because they have a degree, but because they're in the field.
The Natural Resources Commission will most likely take up the proposals at a meeting in May. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lindsay Wright.
By the way, DNR officials say that if a hunting season's approved, it would be highly regulated and a quota would be implemented. In addition, the hunters would have to report a bobcat caught within 24 hours to make sure that all the numbers are up to date. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. It's almost that time for a week of great jazz. It'll be next week at Valparaiso University, as jazz is performed by high school students and professionals. I talked at length with Professor Jeff Brown at Valparaiso University, who is the creator of the annual jazz festival. Jeff, if you will, give us an idea of the rundown for the 33rd annual. Oh, 33rd annual jazz festival at Valparaiso University.
I started when I was 8 years old.
It seems like it. I'm sure. I know.
No, yeah. We're very excited about this year. This is our 33rd year, and it involves some of the things that we've kind of become known for, and a few brand new twists. The Monday on April 2nd, we have some local high school jazz ensembles, some of them who have performed there in the past, a nice representation of various counties. We have Chesterton and Portage from Porter County. We have Hobart from Lake County. Of course, Valparaiso will be there. And a brand new ensemble to the festival this year, Kankakee Valley, will be there. And it's an interesting part of the festival because these ensembles are used to doing festivals, but they're very competitive festivals. And they're adjudicated and you win awards and all those things. And I don't have a problem with those. There's a place for those. But when I started doing this back many years back, I thought that there would be a place for a festival that the students could come and perform in a professional environment without the rigors of being adjudicated. That's what it is. They come and they perform in a professional environment. Each of them prepare about a 22-minute set. And we pretty much stay on time.
They probably enjoy this more so than the judged events because they get to perform, they get to play, and they get to have fun. It's a way to show off your skills, and certainly to them it is because they're budding musicians, to be sure. But they're really learning how to be really true jazz musicians this way, aren't they?
True, and a lot of the directors like it just as much as well. The students over the years, interestingly, I've had many of them come to study at VU with me. That the first, my first encounters with them have been them appearing at the festival in high school. And they say to me that performing at VU's festival was, they personally did some of their best playing because they didn't feel the pressure that a lot of the other adjudicated festivals like well, other universities and other right. other places.
Okay. Now, of course, after we get the students coming in and showing their stuff, first of the week here, by the time we get to Wednesday and Thursday in particular, we get to hear more from your groups here at Valparaiso University. Tell us what the Jazz Ensemble has in store when they have their concerts on Thursday evening.
Well, Don Braden is an excellent jazz tenor saxophonist, arranger, composer, clinician. His style of playing is a very blues, soulful, stylistic way, but within a very advanced harmonic tinge to it. His compositions are very challenging. The Jazz Ensemble will be performing five of his original compositions and arrangements. We also commissioned a work which is called Eddie-ish, which is a composition in the style of Eddie Harris, which was a friend of Don Braden's. Kind of those of you who are listening out there, kind of in the 1960s Les McCann, Eddie Harris type of sound. And so we'll be premiering those. And the Jazz Ensemble this year has some very strong student improvisers. And so it's a very great experience for them to be able to be exposed to someone of his talents.
Now we come up to Friday here of the concert, which, of course, will be Friday, April 6th, and we have the headline acts, so to speak, coming in, the professionals coming into town to do the performance for everybody who wants to attend. I know that the tickets always seem to disappear at the Hara Union for the weekend coming up here. And we have, I guess, first you have the opening act is the Bill Boris Trio. Folks that maybe are not familiar with Bill Boris, tell us a little bit about him.
Well, Bill is a native of this area. He grew up in Munster and in Gary, and I've known him since we were both 10. And Bill is one of the finest jazz guitarists in the United States. He's a professor at Columbia in Chicago, and he has an organ trio that'll be performing as the warm-up act for Tierney Sutton, and that's a Hammond B3 organ, guitar, and drums. It's a very unique, incredibly big sound. It's very nice, and he'll be doing some of his own compositions and some standards. Tierney Sutton is an amazing vocalist. She's one of these vocalists that is certainly strongly rooted in the jazz vein, but her repertoire is so broad. It's R&B, rock, everything.
Hide my face. driven to tears, driven to tears.
She's one of the vocalists out there that truly utilizes her voice as a unique instrument in an instrumental context with a trio behind her. It's not just singing lyrics. It's her scatting, acting and reacting with the various instruments in the ensemble. Her group was nominated for a Grammy in just ensemble arranging, which is quite amazing.
Do you get the impression that she basically obviously have learned very well the styles of not only Ella Fitzgerald when you talk about scat singing, but also even going back even as far as Billie Holiday, who was able to use her voice as an instrument, was considered as much if not more of a musician rather than a vocalist?
Especially Billie Holiday's text there, but you know, you talk about Ella Fitzgerald, and you talk about the establishment of quite an art form of being able to meander from a lyric to scatting. Mm-hmm. Some of those great recordings of, like the one recording that comes to mind is she's performing live "Mac the Knife," mm-hmm. and she forgets the lyrics, but she remembers all the modulations, and she scats through the entire tune, and it's For those out there listening, they know the exact recording I'm talking about. It's absolutely amazing, yeah. And so yes, Tierney is a vocalist that has a strong respect and knowledge of the past, but is certainly forging an incredible future.
We're talking with Jeff Brown about the 33rd Annual Jazz Festival coming up at Valparaiso University. And we've had enough festivals now, and certainly since the very beginning, Jeff, you've seen how it has evolved. And I guess how jazz has evolved as well, too. You take us back to the first ones. What were some of the great artists and other people that came on early in the evolution of the Jazz Fest, and how has the music itself changed over the years to bring us to this point now for this year to have the artists coming up here on this 33rd annual event?
Interestingly, from the VU Faculty Jazz Trio was the very first act 33 years ago, and what's kind of transformed a little bit over the past maybe 20 some years is that individual jazz artists aren't going out and performing with in-house rhythm sections as much as they used to. Mm-hmm. You find there being more organized groups going out. In the earlier years, the trio played with people like Slide Hampton, Art Farmer, incredible musicians. And then indeed what I would be able to do is parlay those performances in with them doing appearances with the University Jazz Ensemble. There's still the same types of ensembles out there. There are big bands, there's trios, there's quartets, there's chamber ensembles, literally of every size. I think that what you're seeing at festivals worldwide is presentations by smaller groups due to the nature of the whole international booking situation that is going on. And I think that, but if people really want to look for festivals that have big bands, those are out there as well. Also, festivals have gotten very specialized. There's traditional jazz festivals. There's festivals that highlight various compositional styles. There's a difference between university types of festivals and professional festivals and how they're approached. So there's something out there for everybody. I just think people need to look a little bit harder.
Well, Jeff Brown, thank you very much for talking about this festival coming up, the 33rd Annual Valparaiso University Jazz Festival.
Thank you.
There's one building on 35th Avenue. It's been there since, I believe, the early or mid-60s, 1960s. So mm-hmm. It gives you an idea how, how long we've been in there, and with people, it's the ones who, I'm dating myself now, there was at one time trailers that were actually, that were near that older building.
That's Ivy Tech Community College, Northwest Indiana Chancellor Luis Gonzalez, talking about the fact that the old 35th Avenue building for the campus is closing and the shifting operations into the newly built IU Northwest Arts and Sciences building.
What we call the South Building.
Right.
And over the years, it has evolved. The newer building, the North Building, was built in the 1990s. But as times have changed and we made the commitment to be down the street at IUN, the new IUN Arts and Sciences Building, it's a beautiful building on the corner of 35th and Broadway. We've partnered with IUN, and so we've expanded our offerings there. So we will be offering chemistry and biology majors there as well. And so then it was decided that our footprint would change. And so since we're going to be offering a majority of our classes over at the new Arts and Sciences Building, and our technology programs, we can move actually across the street. We can repurpose the buildings and the land that we currently are located in. Certainly, we're there to do what's best for the city of Gary. We shouldn't be defined by a building or two. It should be defined by our commitment. And so that's what we're looking at and how we better make use of the space that we have. And it goes back to what our president said, who also indicated that, you know, we're there to look at our square footage. You know, are we maximizing the use of our square footage? Is it worth our while in terms of are we saving the taxpayer dollars? And so that was all considered. And so that's one of the reasons why we made a decision to change the footprint.
You mentioned briefly here some of the programs that Ivy Tech Community College offers that they are going to be relocated or are, if they haven't already, will be into the Arts and Sciences Building. What else do you hope that Ivy Tech Community College can take away from the opportunity to be so close to the IU Northwest campus?
We have a program, it's called the ABC program, and it's ABC stands for Associate Plus Bachelor's Equals Career. And so that's an agreement that was put together in place with IUN and some of the northern Indiana Ivy Tech campuses. And so basically what that is that you would complete your studies, your associate degree at Ivy Tech, and if you would consider attending Indiana University, Northwest, that you would, or Kokomo or the South Bend campus, you could participate in the Summer Bridge Program, and then all these credits would transfer over to IUN. And so, again, we're making better use of the space that's being provided for us. But, you know, like in real estate, you know, they say what a location, location, location. To be given access to right on the corner of 35th and Broadway, which I believe is the gateway, right off the interstate, off 8094, as you're coming down Broadway, and to partner with IU, a fine institution like Indiana University Northwest, and to have access to all those students and the traffic that's there, it would be beneficial to the college, and so it really would be a win-win for us. And so our students love it. This past fall, we began with 29 classes, and we're up to 102 this spring, and we hope to double that for this coming term, this coming fall term.
Wow, that's great. That's great. When you talk about the relocation need that comes about when you deal with an older building, like the building on 35th has been there since 1968, what kind of maintenance problems, I suppose, more than anything else, that preclude the need to have to try and fix up a building? It's better to move into a new building.
Yeah, it's like anything else. It's, you know, when individuals have to make decisions, whether it's a vehicle that had seen its better days or a home that has seen its better days, and you have to make decisions. Is it worth your while to continue to invest money in a vehicle or in a home or an apartment? Is it worth your while? And so we had to start making hard decisions about that sort of thing. We were putting just an inordinate amount of money in terms of repairs when it came to like heating and air issues, air conditioning issues. It was constant, and it wasn't fair to our staff and to our students who had to deal with that and grapple with that from time to time, dealing with air conditioning issues, heating issues. And there were times when I would actually walk through the building, and you see staff in in overcoats during the wintertime. That's not fair to them, and certainly not fair to our students.
Now, when we talk about shifting some programs currently at the Ivy Tech Community College building on 35th over to the Gary Area Career Center, what types of programs do you think that Ivy Tech can benefit from that shift?
You know, what we're looking for, because our technology programs are housed in that same building that we were just referring to. So the space is very limited there. It's very tight. So I'll give you an example. Our welding labs, we offer a number of welding courses there. But the challenges we have there is space. And so the sections are small. We can't really expand the way we would like to. We have workforce alignment courses, which are your non-traditional training courses in welding that could not be offered because of space. Going right across the street, literally going across the street at the Gary Career Center, those problems are disappear. Mm-hmm. Because they have ample space. And so that's the reason why that drew our attention to the Gary Career Center. And so Michelle Meadows, who's the executive director there, has been more than gracious to allow us to walk through the building, and a number of my cabinet has gone through the building, and they see what I see. There's a lot of potential there.
That's great.
And room for expansion, especially when it comes to training.
What kind of efforts are underway to make sure that the city of Gary doesn't end up with another building that's vacant and can't be reused?
Oh, yes. We're a good neighbor. I've met with the mayor. I've assured her that we're not going to abandon the building, own the property. We're there to repurpose the property. And so we've been already contacted by some organizations, some businesses about selling the property. And so we will look at all offers, and we will entertain all these offers. And then I'm sure with our legal department, we will look at all that and look at what's best for not only the college, but also what's best for the communities. We're there to be a good neighbor, and we are not there to abandon the property.
Ivy Tech Community College Northwest Indiana Chancellor Luis Gonzalez talking about the move and closing of the old 35th Avenue building in Gary for the Gary campus, and shifting operations over to some space planned from the Gary Career Center, as well as the Indiana University Northwest Arts and Sciences building, which was also built originally with the idea of having Ivy Tech there. Time now for Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Marilyn Stuckert, the manager of the Northwest Indiana Symphony Youth Orchestra. Marilyn, you've been the manager now for how long?
5 years.
5 years. And your own daughter was in the youth orchestra.
She was.
So that's how you first got involved.
Yes, I was just a parent volunteer.
Unpaid parent.
Yes.
And then you ascended to a paid position.
Yes.
That was good, and you've done such a fine job.
Thank you.
So, Marilyn, you have a fundraiser coming up on April the 5th?
6th.
April the 6th for the Youth Orchestra. For the past several years, the Youth Orchestra has been involved with South Shore Dance Alliance and some other youth arts organizations through Leap into the Arts, raising money through Leap into the Arts. Now there is no more Leap into the Arts.
Right. We stopped this year, and it hasn't been decided if we'll return or not, but we are trying our own fundraiser
mm-hmm.
this year.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Mm-hmm. And South Shore Dance Alliance is having its 10th anniversary?
Yes, they are.
Yeah, so mm-hmm. that's great. They're doing their own thing this year. So what is our own thing going to be like?
Our own thing is called the Showcase Gala, mm-hmm. and we are going to be highlighting music from our past performances this year,
mm-hmm.
Things we did at the Rock and Rails concert in mm-hmm. Griffith at Labor Day,
mm-hmm.
things we did at our December concert,
mm-hmm.
and then a little preview of what's coming up for our May concert. And we're also going to highlight our chamber groups that normally perform.
They keep busy, those chamber groups.
They do. Yes.
I know that we trot them out on every possible occasion. They performed most recently at the Symphony Gala on February 17th, and they performed through the whole cocktail hour part of the evening, and mm-hmm. people always enjoy hearing. And then at our concerts.
They are at the concerts, right before the concert and during intermission. And then they do some private gigs. They have done weddings.
Mm-hmm.
They are going to be doing this summer. The Lake County Public Library Cherville branch
mm-hmm.
is their summer reading program is called Music. And so they're going to be performing at that, too.
What would the Showcase Gala be like?
Well, it's
in addition to the music that's
yes,
being performed.
It will have a cocktail hour, silent auction. We've got some wonderful things coming in for the silent auction. And then we have dinner, and then the performance after that. And we also have a wine pull and a 50-50 raffle going on, too.
So the whole nine yards,
yes,
as they say.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's good. And then how many kids are involved in the youth orchestra?
We have 60 this year.
And they meet September through May?
Yes.
Pretty much?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. They rehearse on Sunday afternoons?
Sunday afternoons, 2 o'clock at the Center for Visual and Performing Arts.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And how does one get into said orchestra if one wants to?
They audition. And we have upcoming spring auditions on May 19th and 20th. And the information is on our website and the music that they need to know and the dates and the sign-up and everything.
Are there age restrictions?
It's grades 7 through 12.
Okay. So once you graduate from high school...
We have taken on occasion about a freshman in college. Mm-hmm. Usually then they tend to get a little too busy, but there's an occasion where we have taken some.
So there's just a natural turnover because of moving on, aging, the aging population of the Symphony Youth Orchestra.
We graduate about 12 a year and then add on 12 to 15 each year.
And you have a really exciting trip. Sometimes the orchestra takes trips.
Yes, we do. We've started now about every 4 years trying to really branch out. In 14, we went to Germany and Austria, and now coming up this summer, we're going to Italy.
Mm-hmm. And will the orchestra be performing?
Yes, we
in
will.
Venues throughout Italy.
We have five opportunities to perform.
That's exciting. What cities are you going to perform in?
Rome and Cremona and Milan, and we're very excited. Excited about it.
Is Cremona where the violins come from?
I believe so, yes.
I think that's been in my crossword puzzles, that Amati is a frequent answer.
Yes.
Well, that's exciting. So it's not just performing here in Northwest Indiana, but there could be the opportunity for world travel.
Yes, it's a great experience for the kids to be involved in it and get
some real
opportunities to perform.
Well, they have good parents who make sure that they take advantage of these opportunities.
Very much, yes.
All right, Marilyn. Well, thank you for being here. Good luck with the Showcase Gala. I'll be there.
Good.
Because I'll get fired if I don't come.
Oh.
I know. I mean, I'll be there because I want to be there.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for being here, Marilyn, and thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And if you missed any portion of this conversation, you can listen during All Things Considered, and it's also going to be on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking. For today, I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow. Donna Stuckert from Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction will be with us with All Things Composting in Porter County.